This is an ABC podcast.
It's the anniversary of the Eureka Stockade Rebellion, widely considered the birth of Australian democracy. But the crowd celebrating in Ballarat are dwindling.
If we told the truth a little bit more about exactly what happened, I think a lot more young people would feel that they were part of it.
Right to defend
our rights and liberties.
And the fight to counteract Australia's mammal extinction rate.
Look, Australia has the worst mammal extinction rate in the world. Let's turn back that tide of extinctions. And the only way we can do that is by getting boots on the ground to do the really important work that needs to happen out at places like Mallee Cliffs.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. To be acknowledged is the first step towards true inclusion. That's how National Disability Discrimination Commissioner Dr. Ben Gauntlett signed off his op-ed piece in the Sydney Morning Herald today. That's certainly been the case for 21-year-old Tarang farmer Celia Nash. She has Down syndrome, and with the help of her family and a supportive community, she's met life head on. Emily Bisland with this story.
Righto, let him out.
Come on, baby.
Not all. We don't want all. He'll chase the cattle.
It's a glorious blue sky day on the Nash family's cattle farm in the Western District of Victoria near a little town called Camperdown.
I live on a farm with beef cattle.
Celia is 21 and champing at the bit to go and help her dad, Alastair, move some cattle on their farm.
All right, are you ready to put your helmet on? Is that tight enough?
Yeah. Come on, girl.
So you put him on the bike and then we'll just wander down.
Also excited are the family's two Dachshunds, who go everywhere that Celia goes. They jump on the back of her four-wheeler motorbike and she starts it up.
Seals has had a really farm-based childhood.
This is Celia's mum, Caroline Nash.
And she loves going out on the farm with Dad.
I usually have him move cattle and feed cattle and open gates for him. He does the tractor, I do the motorbike.
Keep going up and get the cattle. I'll get the gate.
Celia is the picture of a true farmer's daughter as she traverses the lush green paddocks, her dad in the four-wheel drive following close behind.
Just so drive up there and go round the back of them and bring them back.
Be careful on the rocks, love.
There's been nothing that she hasn't been allowed to do that Big Sister hasn't either. She is a farm kid, but she's a hard little worker too. Yeah, she's a pretty good stick. Seals wasn't diagnosed at birth. She wasn't diagnosed in utero. She was about 6 months old. She was breastfeeding, but she had been a bit unwell. Not enough for me to think there was anything super wrong. We ended up at the doctor's and I just said to him, can you tell me what you're doing and what you think's wrong? And he said, I think she's got Down syndrome. And my husband and I can't explain to you how we felt. I think I cried for about 2 days. Just picked myself up and went, I don't know why you're crying. Your world's changed a little, but not a lot. I feel a bit teary thinking about it, but it's been a wonderful ride we've had with Seals. There's been days that have been not so good. I think that's like any child, but there's been days that are pretty good.
Mum, do you want anything done?
I just want you to make a service train. Could you do that for me, darling?
When you see Celia on her four-wheeler and helping Mum out in the kitchen, chopping spinach and frying eggs, it's hard to imagine that life was ever difficult for her. But what I'm seeing today is actually the product of so many hard years of Celia and her mum and her dad and sister working so hard at day-to-day tasks that might take most of us just a couple of tries to learn.
Tying our shoelaces, maybe year 10. So the determination of this little girl is incredible because every morning, you know, we tie those shoes in knots. But I have a very, very determined young lady and she keeps going and going.
And the people who currently most benefit from Celia's hard work and determination are the customers and her colleagues at the cafe she works at. the little acorn.
She's a doer. Celia likes to get in and work, and she never stops. We have to repeatedly ask her to stop and have lunch now, or it's morning tea time and she just wants to keep going.
That was Jenny O'Keefe, who also works at the Little Acorn and helped get it off the ground 4 years ago.
The turkey and ham.
The turkey one's here.
So one wants turkey and one's ham.
Her job is her world.
Love coming here. The Little Acorn.
Here's Jenny again.
So I guess we talk about disability, but here at the Acorn we talk about ability.
What's that come here, no?
No, a large flat white.
A large flat white.
We don't show any difference in uniforms or name badges. We don't broadcast that we're a disability service cafe. The locals have always known that and always supported us, but if we get travellers and they're not familiar with who we are and what we are, it just flies by them. So that's a good thing.
I like working hard and I like it when it's more busy and the time gets quick. Serving meals out, coffees out. I like doing the teal, that's my favourite thing.
One sugar.
One skinny or full cream?
Full cream and very hot.
Very hot.
Very hot.
The Little Acorn is a special place. It's right on the highway that goes straight through the little town of Terang, which is about 40 minutes from Warrnambool. Inside, it's a bustling hub of locals, the Mum and Bubs group, the dairy farmers who have just come off the farm for a quick coffee. There's a really cosy feel in there. It's homely. You can buy local honey or flowers and lemons that have been donated. And best of all, everybody calls each other by their first name.
I do often get told by seals, though, you know, I saw such and such today, Mum, or I saw such and such today, or someone's been in for their kappa. So I'm all over what's going on in Terang.
I think that's been a really important part of the Acorn, that we have become a social hub for our community. Our participants, they're greeted by the locals by their first name. And I think that could be lost in a larger town.
An old gentleman wanders in with wild windswept hair. He's every bit the dairy farmer in his red checkered flannelette shirt. He orders a coffee and sits down. Celia brings him out his change.
There you go, Mink.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Celia.
And you got a coin.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Good on you.
That's all right. I like meeting new friends, talking to them. And I like them knowing me, and it feels so good and emotional. When we were in lockdown, was it open? And I missed them, but it's good to be back.
Passers-by will get a taste of the magic that happens in this cafe just by ordering a coffee or stopping in for lunch. But some of the really good stuff happens behind the scenes.
You'll see people down the street and they'll say, oh, hi, Seals. It's a reflection of the community. It's really beautiful.
Someone might say, oh, I've seen you at the cafe or you've served me at the cafe. And that's just a starting point for that socialisation and that normalisation that's so important for all of us, so that we're not focusing on disability.
When you send your child with special needs off into that bigger world without you hovering, your heart's beating just a little bit faster. But the value that Seals has here, Seals has a place in society here. She has a place at home too. But she has got lots of courage and lots of determination, and I think that's what's got her to this point.
Emily Bisland reporting from Terang in Victoria as part of the ABC's coverage for International Day of People with Disability.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
A few minutes before dawn this morning, a group of anarchists burnt an effigy of the Commonwealth Attorney General, Christian Porter, at the site of the Eureka Stockade in Ballarat. It's 166 years since government troops stormed rebel gold miners camped at the site, culminating in a fiery battle that killed at least 28 men. The ageing activist collective, still carrying the torch for the annual Dawn commemoration, blame apathy for their dwindling support. And the youngest member in the crowd says if the story was told in a way that's more inclusive, it could invite more interest from the next generation. Charlotte King has this story.
It takes less than a minute before the cardboard effigy of the nation's Attorney General, Christian Porter, disappears in flames.
We need to remember it's not the man, is the position he holds and the extreme authority he holds.
Melbourne's veteran anarchist, Joe Toscano, leads the small crowd through the morning's solemn commemoration.
The Victoria Police, who had been in constant battle with the miners, went around up to 5 kilometres from here, burning tents, robbing gold.
Today's event marks 166 years since dozens of miners were killed at the rebellion camp during their revolt against the colonial government. It's not a round number, but that doesn't stop the dozen or so men and women who rose before dawn to be here.
Eureka was not about mining licences, as people like to think about it. That was the catalyst which brought people together. But it was about fundamental rights and freedoms. The difference between 1854 and 2020 is, in 1854, people believed they had fundamental rights.
The community broadcaster and medical practitioner says he started the event almost 20 years ago in the absence of a local Dawn commemoration.
This city conveniently forgets to celebrate on the 3rd of December. Apart from a few little events, nothing happens. No public holiday, no march. Ballarat has always been ashamed of this armed rebellion.
But others dispute this characterisation. Down the hill from where we're standing is the city's Eureka Centre, home to the original Eureka flag itself and other exhibits celebrating its history.
Sorry, it's a bit of a process, so just bear with me.
The manager, Anthony Cam, has come alone to let the small group into the council-owned building after hours to view the flag. One by one, the old anarchists are signed in, graciously accepting the COVID-19 protocols.
We're in a different world now where people are busier and there's less of an investment by volunteers in the delivering of events. So, of course, historically there was some great early morning events. There was the Dawn Walks, which was strongly run by volunteers. So that ended quite a while ago. We do a commemorative service usually at 9 a.m, and that seems to be a good time for most people.
That event appears comparatively underwhelming and in the COVID context consists of the city mayor, Daniel Maloney, laying a wreath before a handful of journalists. But Mr Maloney says there's no doubt the city embraces the Eureka story.
To some degree, it's people building maybe their own truths or their own stories around it, but really it's a day that provokes that, which is, I don't see that as a problem. I see that as actually a really good thing. We have a democracy where we can speak our minds and we can protest. And that comes from this moment here.
Santila Chingaipe was the youngest to make the Dawn service and was asked to read the Eureka Oath for the others.
We swear by the Southern Cross
to stand truly by each other.
To stand truly by each other.
And my connection to it has been in recent years finding out that, you know, two of the men that were sort of tried for treason were of African descent. I thought it was about white people. I thought it was about white Australians. And also when you think about how the Southern Cross flag has been co-opted in recent years, whether it's with white nationalist groups and things like that, as someone that's black, of African descent, and an Australian, you feel like you're not part of this country. You feel like you're constantly being excluded. But to find out that on one of the most significant events that changed, you know, the way we look at democracy in this country, changed how we see ourselves, if there were people that, like me, that were fighting for that, it makes me feel like I've belonged since the start. And that's huge. Like, if we told the truth a little bit more about exactly what happened, I think a lot more young people would feel that they were part of it.
Right to defend
our rights and liberties.
Hear, hear.
The man at the centre of today's event, the Attorney General Christian Porter, wasn't aware that an effigy made in his image had been burnt until we contacted him for a response. In a statement, Mr Porter said he strongly supported the right to peaceful protest.
Charlotte King reporting there from Ballarat in Victoria.
ABC Australia Wide.
I think it's wonderful. I think everyone should come and see it.
On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. The Bureau of Meteorology's latest climate outlook has predicted a strong wet season for most of eastern Australia, with outback Queensland preparing itself for extreme heat and potential cyclones. But that's no match for grey nomads, families and tourists hitting the road. As Kimmy Maguire reports, what should have been off-season for northwest Queensland tourism has turned into one of its busiest years yet.
Queensland's weather, possible showers and storms
and
tomorrow.
And the weather for Western Queensland, very hot and a sunny morning in the Channel Country.
Remaining hot to very hot in the south and southwest with some raised dust. Final.
Hearing about 40 degree heat and oncoming thunderstorms doesn't normally attract you to go sightseeing. I mean, you wouldn't find it on a travel brochure. But despite the conditions, hundreds of cars and caravans are still hitting the road to outback Queensland on what would normally be the tourist off-season. Carol Khan runs the caravan park in Julia Creek and has been running at a 95% capacity over the past month.
Previous managers had called through and said that it was much quieter at this time. Very few vans at all pulling through. You were just about empty in the van park. We would be at the moment maybe once a week have one night where one's not filled.
Further west, Rick Clues runs a caravan park in Mount Isa and says not only are cabins being booked now, but they're getting filled in the new year.
Our cabins are actually busier now than any time of the year. As soon as the Northern Territory border opened, it was quite good. June, July, we were getting 30 vans a day some days. It was crazy busy and it wasn't expected, but we get a lot of pre-bookings for August. This year there was no rodeo, so next year August will be really heavily booked.
Yeah, g'day. I'm Adam Kavanagh, and for the last 4 years, I've just been in my car travelling Australia. One thing I've really noticed up here, it's definitely like, I guess it's not the tourist season at the moment. It's like, you know, in the middle of the wet, it's absolutely hot. In all my time travelling Australia, I've never seen this amount of tourists still up here with the heat and the wet. Like, that's been new to me, to see people still travelling in what you'd call bad weather, I guess. The more hardcore grey nomads that are still up here.
Adam knows all too well about an outback wet season. He was stuck in the Gulf of Carpentaria for around 3 weeks last year.
Yeah, the last time I was up here in the Gulf, I'm mates with a few people up in Doomadgee. And yeah, last year it got cut off pretty significantly, actually. Like, from what I've heard, this year is meant to be a pretty substantial flood. So yeah, basically in Doomadgee where I am, it's completely cut off. So yeah, food and stuff has to get flown in.
Were you expecting the wet? Had anyone told you that Doomadgee gets cut off?
I wasn't actually. Like, I knew about the wet season up north, like I've experienced it before, but in Doomadgee itself, I really didn't realise it actually completely gets cut off from the outside world. It definitely caught me off guard, that's for sure.
Kimmy McGuire reporting there from Mount Isa in Queensland.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
Australia has the worst mammal extinction rate in the world. And to counter that, 10 native mammals that have been extinct in New South Wales for more than a century are slowly being introduced to a national park in the state's southwest. Yesterday, the numbat got its turn. 5 were released into a predator-free fenced area of Mallee Cliffs National Park as part of a plan to rewild that area. Deborah Pearce was there for the event and spoke with senior wildlife ecologist Dr. Lawrence Berry.
For the last 2 weeks, our team of ecologists and volunteers have been out searching during the day for numbats running around. And when they spot one, they follow it and pursue it to a den site, which is either in a log or in a burrow. And then you go through a process of extracting it. So that often involves, you know, plugging up all the holes in the log with rags. And then you staple a sort of like a shrimp net over the end. And then you blow a bit of hose pipe down the log. And the numbat runs out into the net and then you catch it. And so that we can have a release where we release all the numbats in one day, we put radio collars on and release them back at Scotia. So the tricky thing when doing a numbat translocation is that they eat termites. So they're very difficult to hold in captivity. So once you've caught them, you have to put a tracker on them and release them again and then go through a process like we did last night of catching them up again. One of the special things about numbats is that the females establish unique territories. So the females hold their own territory of anywhere between a quarter hectare to a few hectares. And then you have males that roam over multiple female territories. So at this time of the year, you know, the female have just weaned their young from last season have departed. And then in January, that's really the breeding season. So the numbats are a particularly challenging species because there's this really narrow window in time when you can go and catch them without interfering with that breeding cycle.
They're super cute and furry and fun to look at, but obviously you're preserving the population. At the same time, the numbats have an important part to play in this system, don't they?
Well, that's right. So the really exciting thing about this project here at Mallee Cliffs National Park is that we're rewilding the park. We're reintroducing 10 regionally extinct mammal species that all play different roles in the ecosystems. It's quite rare in the context of these reintroduction projects, and it's really a pioneering feature of this project. Numbats themselves are a termite specialist, so they'll engage with that part of the ecosystem. But they're also an important part of the food web. You know, once the population's established, there'll be relationships between those numbats and native predators and other animals. So one of the interesting things about this project is just to see the environment restore itself to what it was 200 years ago before that critical weight range mammal fauna was decimated by feral cats and foxes. We know that those species were here from the subfossil records, from middens up the Darling River, from local indigenous knowledge. We know that those species coexisted in this environment. But, you know, we've not had them here with modern science to look and understand at how they all interact together. So it's an exciting project. It's pioneering. Here with the numbat, we expect to see a 30% increase in the global population size of the species. And it's great to see the investment in this sort of large-scale conservation project out in the regions.
Atticus Fleming, Deputy Secretary, National Parks and Wildlife Service. This project is actually about restoring the bush. You know, it's about getting animals back that have been missing for over a century. So the vision here, if you like, the dream, is to be able to come to Mallee Cliffs into this feral-free area and see the bush as it was a couple of hundred years ago. You know, the way Aboriginal people looked after country for so long.
There are amazing partnerships, and the way that the parks work together across the state and across the country is pretty incredible. How do you find it working across such a broad base of partnerships?
Look, Australia has the worst mammal extinction rate in the world, and I think that tragedy unites people, it unites organisations. You know, we've got and we really need a common purpose, which is let's turn back that tide of extinctions. And the only way we can do that is by getting boots on the ground to do the really important work that needs to happen out at places like Mallee Cliffs, and by harnessing the strengths of, you know, all of the organisations, what we've all got to offer. And when Australians do that, when there's more awareness about what's at stake, you know, what we could lose, I think that's when Australians are ready to work together even more closely, even with greater strength to turn around that tide of extinctions.
Atticus Fleming, Deputy Secretary of the National Parks and Wildlife Service, ending that story from Deborah Pearce, since she was at Mallee Cliffs National Park. Today marks the 75th birthday of ABC Rural and the Country Hour. And for those of us, like Australia-wide's producer Alex Hyman and I, who worked on the Country Hour, it's been great to be part of what is Australia's longest-running radio show. Country Hour got its start at a pivotal time in Australia's history, immediately after the Second World War. And here's a recording of the last broadcast by Harry Greaves, past Queensland Country Hour presenter, and he captures what was the essence of the Rural Department.
Today, Harry Greaves, the ABC Supervisor of Rural Broadcast for Queensland, retires after 40 years' service. This is perhaps Harry's last broadcast, an overview of the Rural Department and a chance for him to say goodbye.
Thanks very much, John. When I began work in the Rural Department, it was just after the Second World War, and the war had ravaged countries, particularly Europe, and people were very short of food. The pressure was on to produce more and more in Australia to meet this demand, and also as a humanitarian gesture. It was a time too when technical change was coming increasingly to farming. The farming community were conservative, much as they are now, in their approach to this change. Understandably, in my book, there's never been any shortage of city-based critics, windbag politicians, and comfortably tenured academics urging farmers as how to conduct their own business. And if the farmer failed, well, he's still left standing in the paddock. So the ABC's Rural Department was born out of the need to produce and to get new ideas across to the farming community. We thought it important that they hear other farmers rather than a lot I've referred to in such unflattering terms.
A blast from the past. Harry Greaves, Queensland Country Hour presenter for 40 years, and that recording from the ABC archives. And it was originally recorded on a quarter-inch analogue audio tape. And that's it from the Australia-wide team for today. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. And there'll be some Country Hour presenters around the country cracking some champagne tonight. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.